ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
At a rural picnic spot in the dark, a young man suddenly disappears.
You could nearly say an alien took him away because he's just vanished.
When more clues from that night surface, something doesn't sit right.
It's nonsensical where the stuff is. It's been scattered.
I'm Rob Bergen. Join me as I investigate what became of Jack in the new season of Unravel.
Is it a murder? Is it someone just gone missing?
You know where my son is.
Search for the Unravel podcast on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Well, this week, the Albanese government passed the first tranche of its budget tax legislation through the lower house of parliament. Next stop, the Senate. But since the budget, there have been howls of angst and anger from business, large and small, and investors, young and old. The government, though, remains determined to push its tax changes through the parliament with only minimal concessions. I'm David Lipson on Ngunnawal Country here in Parliament House in Canberra. Welcome to Insiders on Background. Well, one prominent voice of opposition that we've heard since the budget is a former advisor to Prime Minister Kevin Rudd. His name is Lachlan Harris. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, David. Great to be here.
Lachlan, you obviously understand the Labor Party very well, but you're also a successful entrepreneur post-politics, so you are uniquely placed to assess and perhaps critique the budget, and you have done that with a few comments, particularly the capital gains tax element, which you've come out strongly against. Why do you think there's been such a strong reaction against this Albanese government budget?
Yeah, look, the first thing I want to say is there's a lot to like about this budget. There was a lot of political bravery around the negative gearing stuff and even around the introduction of CGT on investment in residential investment properties. They were big calls, they were risky calls, they were hard calls, and I think they were the right call. Unfortunately, I think in the process of kind of stepping up to those big political decisions, the budget just went way too far. It overstepped into an area where the consideration, the consultation, the detail was not really nearly as well thought through, and that is around the application, the change of a discount in the CGT tax system and replacing that with indexation. And what that has, I think it's unfortunately had a really, really, really negative impact in terms of the formation of new businesses, both by young founders, by investors who want to invest in highly, highly, highly risky investments in early stage businesses, and also by the employees that may join them, take a pay cut and take some equity. And I want to make it really, really clear, this is not just about, you know, the top tier AI tech startups. My first business was Budgie Smuggler. Mm. It's a swimwear business. Mm. It's a really great, fun business. They're made in Marrickville. They still are today. I sold the business years ago. It, you know, there's lots of good jobs created there in manufacturing in a very hard environment. There's not many clothing brands that manufacture in Australia and export overseas. But that product is now sold all over the world. It's a great, fun Australian business. It creates jobs in Australia, real, meaningful jobs. It also exports a bit of wonderful, fun, larrikin Aussie culture. And that is really, really important that we protect that flame of entrepreneurialism in young Australians. And I think, unfortunately, I think the government did have genuinely good intentions here, and I think there was a lot of very, very well-considered and very politically brave things in the budget. Unfortunately, I think this is a misstep. And the only reason I'm engaging really is because I hope that the government can kind of correct course and get back on with the rest of the important jobs that are there in the budget.
Let's just stick with the company that you founded and sold. I think you did pretty well out of it, Budgie Smugglers. Under the old scheme, as you pointed out, you would have got a 50% discount on the tax you paid at sale. The new system would have seen you get a tax discount still, but based on inflation. And if I could take you back to the inception of that company, I mean, do you think that tax change would really have discouraged you or diverted you away from that entrepreneurial spirit that you had at the start there?
Look, it's a good question. And I'm not one of those people who's running around saying, oh, everyone's going to pack up and move to Singapore. It's not the problem here. The problem is it's a very, very, very vulnerable flame starting a business when you're a young person. I actually started Budgie Smuggler well before I joined. I started working for the Labor Party. I started it when I was 21 years old. And that flame, look, I'm born and bred entrepreneur. I would always want to have a crack. But I think, unfortunately, the more difficult you make it, whether it's the entrepreneur starting, the investment. I never raised capital on that business. You didn't really need any capital. You know, we'd sell 50 pairs of swimmers. We'd get the money. We didn't buy another 50 pairs. So I didn't need to invest. I didn't need to raise capital from people to do that. But all three elements are actually attacked by this switch from discounting to indexation. It's riskier to go in rather than just basically stay in the PAYG system and put your money in your house. It's harder to raise money because the person giving you the check is like, well, actually under the indexation system, large businesses with a large cost base are taxed more effectively, and it's harder to get young employees. So I'm not suggesting that it's going to snuff out every business. But what's really, really important to remember is starting businesses, it's a very difficult, scary thing, and it's a very vulnerable thing. And every change has to be considered very carefully. And I'm not sitting here arguing that any change to the CGT discount would have been a disaster. There is, I think, scenarios where they could have made changes. Maybe it was they drop it from 50 to 40 or some of those sort of more single things. But by shifting, and this is a really important point, by shifting from a discount to an inflation system, an indexation inflation system, what you're doing is the indexation system rewards large businesses that grow slowly with a large cost base. The discount system rewards businesses that have a low cost base, young businesses, small businesses that grow rapidly. And so it's really repurposing the incentives in the system. Forget about this. This is separate to the debate around labor v. capital within the business environment. The replacement of a discount with an inflation indexation scheme actually rewards large businesses that grow slowly and punishes smaller businesses that grow rapidly. And I just think that's the worst possible thing to do in the economic environment we're in. We should be looking for ways to convince young people to start businesses. It's going to get harder and harder to build a career, to spend 20 or 30 years in a safe white-collar job or in a blue-collar job. That's going to get much, much harder as AI and automation, robotics, makes both those areas much more vulnerable to technology disintermediation. We need to make it easier. We need to be promoting people to have a crack and go out there to raise some money from their friends, from their family, from a kind of, maybe they kind of get access to an investor, an angel investor club. We need to make it easier for someone to say, you know what, I'm not going to take a job at PwC or I'm not going to take a job at the Commonwealth Bank. I am going to go and join this little startup and I'm going to have a crack and maybe it works out for me, maybe it don't. Because the important thing to remember is 9 out of 10 of these businesses go nowhere. Mm. They actually go broke. And that a lot of them, the dream doesn't get beyond the founder working on it in his bedroom for two or three years and never actually getting their first customer.
Do you think the Labor government understands that risk, that sort of leap into the unknown that these entrepreneurs
take? It's a very, very, very fine judgment about what will and won't incentivize people. So I'm not pretending that this is some sort of, you know, blunderbuss, terrible kind of malevolent budget. What I'm suggesting is the settings, the way it was announced, the way it's designed, particularly the switching from discounting to indexation, actually shifts the incentives within the business tax system away. It punishes high growth businesses.
What about the carve outs though? I mean, aren't they meant to address that for tech companies and startups?
Well, first of all, it's very important that we don't create an economy that is like the only business that matters is if you're a tech business. My dad, mum and dad were lucky enough, they started Harris Farm Markets when they finished university. That's a really good business. It employs thousands of people. It's a really important business. It's not a tech business. Budgie Smuggler wasn't a tech business. I was lucky. Budgie Smuggler, I sold it a long time ago and I made a couple of $100,000 basically. It was great. It was really important. That seed, that money, I actually put into my next business, which was RevTech Media. That grew into One Big Switch, the 50 Up Club. We operate all around the world. We send young Australians to work in New York and London and Dublin. And so you can't sort of decide which business you want to start. Entrepreneurialism isn't about every single person being a tech entrepreneur. Entrepreneurialism is about what's inside you. What are you capable of building? And the last thing the government should be doing is telling entrepreneurs what sort of business to start. So I don't believe in the tech carve out at all. I think that would be very, actually deeply counterproductive. The second thing is there's a $2 million carve, like not, it's not a carve out, it's basically an exception if you have revenue up to $2 million. The problem with that, Dave, is if you have, speak to anyone who starts a business, they'll tell you the hardest first amount of revenue, the first $500,000 or $1 million is the hardest thing to do. That's really, really hard to get to $1 million and maybe get to $2 million. And the idea that we've solved a problem by putting a ginormous cliff at $2 million and effectively increasing the tax on sale from zero to 47%, every single person out there who's got a business that's turning over $1.5 million, do you know what they really, really, really want to do next year more than anything else? They want to turn over $2.5 million because that means they can employ more people. Maybe they can start, they probably sold their house to start the business. Maybe they can start saving for a house. The carve-outs, the kind of the exceptions don't actually solve the problem, because what they do is they say, let's wait for a business to get really effective, the most productive businesses, the businesses that are creating the most jobs, and go after them, double their tax.
So it wouldn't help to, for example, increase that threshold from 2 million in revenue to 10 million in revenue?
I think what you're doing is you're designing a system that is targeting the businesses that are just getting to the scale where they can really start creating jobs. You know what I mean? So I don't think, that's why I think the carve-out actually, I think the government is going to find it incredibly difficult to design a carve-out that doesn't have consequences that are worse than the actual system itself. And this is why it's a very, very fine debate, because it's not just about lowering the discount to zero. It's about replacing it with indexation. That has changed the incentive both for employees, for investors, and for founders about the way they, what sort of business they start, and do they start a business or do they join a business that's already mature and growing at the inflation rate, therefore pays no CGT. And I just think, unfortunately, the safest way to solve this problem is to say, you know what, there was a national crisis on housing, we had to do something. And they have my absolute full support, not just support, respect. It wasn't easy for Anthony, for the Prime Minister and the Treasurer to basically, they knew they were going to get pinged for breaking a promise, but they did it because it was the right thing to do. And I take my hat off to them. In CGT, just restrict it basically to the housing argument. I think that's a very strong argument. I think it will push capital away from investment property. That's exactly what we want it to do, into things like starting a business. And so I think that would be the right thing to do. And then let's spend a year or two like we have. Labor, remember, has been developing a lot of these policies for 10 years, you know, 2016, 2019. None of that policy, very little of that policy development really went to the CGT on shares. And I think there needs to be a much longer process. And I'm not opposed to some changes. There's lots of entrepreneurs out there who truly want and believe in fairness. It's not kind of, believing in fairness is not a thing that you have to forget about to start a business. And I think there is a fair argument to be made that there needs to be some changes to the system over time. I think the idea that you can rush these out in 2 or 3 weeks and then announce a consultation that's happening after the bill's already gone through Parliament, that's nonsensical. You know, let's be serious about that. That's not a serious consultation at all. I think we do have to go back to first principles, make this budget about housing, take the risk. I think they've got it right on that element, and I think they've got a very strong argument. And I think it's both the right policy and the right politics. I think, unfortunately, the policy, the CGT policy, particularly the indexation, to be really, really clear, the indexation is as big a problem as the reduction in the discount. This is not just about paying more tax, one person paying more tax or another. It's about which businesses are you going to reward. And the indexation rewards slow-growing, very high-cost-based businesses. In other words, businesses that already exist, big businesses that already exist. It punishes early stage businesses that grow quickly. That cannot, there wasn't anyone in the world who was sitting around thinking, we've got a national crisis about how easy it is to start and grow a business. We must tax them back into the sort of Stone Age. No one believed that.
Are you suggesting that there was just a misunderstanding or a lack of appreciation of this area of the business world?
I think it was an unforeseen consequence. Look, this is a smaller end of the business scale. When you're sitting in Canberra, I think you get exposure to very large businesses. You get exposure to superannuation. You get exposure to large, very large listed businesses that by definition, grow slowly. This end of the market, this end of the economy, the end of the economy when you decide to start a business yourself is actually much, much smaller scale. And I don't think it was fully understood what the indexation change would mean. Indexation was introduced in Australia in the 80s and got rid of in the 90s. It basically existed before the internet. And what the internet did was make it much easier to scale businesses rapidly and really quickly. In 1985, in 1989, even in the early 90s, you couldn't start a globally significant business in Australia without, it would take you 20 or 30 years to get there. So indexation made sense at that time. Unfortunately, the world has completely changed now. We are creating globally scaled, massive job creating and wealth creating businesses that like think of the Afterpays, the Canvas. These things are 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 years old. They just didn't exist when indexation was around. Those businesses are hit hardest by this. And I don't mean you necessarily have to be an Afterpay. The business that gets to $10 million in revenue, that's going to have 30, 40, 50 employees, really good quality jobs, jobs that just wouldn't exist if that business wasn't created. And we've designed a system with the solution, the indexation, is a bigger problem than the reduction of the discount. And yes, if you ask me, do I think there was a real consideration and understanding about how that would play out? I would say clearly there wasn't. If there was, you wouldn't have had the Treasurer saying there's going to be consultation in the budget speech. They would have thought through these consequences and made sure they weren't realised. Unfortunately, I would say, and look, I've made a lot of these mistakes myself. I'm not having, you know, I'm not suggesting it was kind of, again, some sort of, it's a fine judgment. I think in the rush of putting this into the budget at the last minute, there was some unforeseen consequences for a very important, very new part of the economy, which is young, high-growth businesses.
So you clearly think it's very bad policy. I want to dig down a little bit further into the politics, not just of this change that we've been focusing on, capital gains tax, but the broader budget, things like the Working Australia tax offset. There is clearly some wealth redistribution at the heart of this budget. What do you make of that? What do you make of the politics more broadly of this budget?
Yeah, it's a fair question. And look, I wouldn't be here having this conversation with you if I just had concerns about the politics of the budget. My days of telling the Labor Party or kind of, you know, giving advice about how to win elections are a long way behind me. But I do, if you ask me, and so I've engaged because I think the policy has very, very negative unforeseen consequences. On the politics, I do think particularly around the CGT, around shares, is also very poor politics, because what it does is sends a message to people who want to create wealth outside their super and outside their principal place of residence that the Labor Party is not a home for you. And actually, I don't think that is a great strategy, particularly given what's happening in the world around the rise of populist parties. It's narrowing Labor's appeal at the very, very moment when we need to broaden it. And this is not like this has not happened in other countries. We've never tried this before. Like Labor itself has tried this strategy before. The New Zealand Labor, the UK Labor, the Democrats in the US, pretty much every centre-left party in the UK. The idea that you can sort of just choose fairness and choose, it's almost like you've got to make a binary choice between fairness and economic growth. And if you just choose fairness, then they're our people, therefore we're going to win the election, therefore everything's good. Unfortunately, we've seen this experiment play out all over the world many times. And when Labor parties basically think they can choose one or the other is when you begin the slow march towards an electoral comeuppance. You know what I mean? And I would argue that we have to do both. A good Labor government has to promote fairness. And that's why I definitely support a lot of the measures in the budget, particularly measures that go directly to making houses more affordable to young people. But we also must promote growth. To be a broad-based party, to be a party that basically can sustain itself against a kind of wave of populist disintermediation, which is happening all over the world and has been growing here for 20 or 30 years now, we need to broaden our appeal. And what this does, particularly I think the way it was announced and some of the communication suggesting that everyone who's arguing against it is peddling in misinformation or is a tech bro or a finance bro, unfortunately, I think that's reinforcing the idea that if you have a dream to create wealth outside of your superannuation fund or outside your principal place of residence, then the Labor Party is not the place for you. And I just don't think that is the right thing to do right now, because there is a lot of people like me, who I've never voted for anyone but Labor my entire life, who believe in starting businesses, who believe in using investing to save money to buy a house. And I'm not suggesting that we're the heart and soul of the Labor Party. Of course we're not, but Labor needs to be a broad-based party in this environment to survive what's coming. And this is narrowing the base, not broadening it. It was described to me as political Ozempic the other day. The more you commit to it, the skinnier your base gets. And I really would say now is not the time to narrow your base. Now is the time to broaden your base. And I think actually...
And what do you mean by that? Is that because of the rise of One Nation? Is that what you're referring to when you talk about an electoral comeuppance?
I think there's a danger, basically, when Labor parties start to kind of focus inwards and narrow their appeal, they eventually... They run out of electoral momentum. And I'm not suggesting this is sort of like, you know, oh, if you pass this budget, you're going to lose the next election. There's a million things that affect election outcomes. What I'm suggesting is the spirit of kind of the general direction that I'm seeing Labor turn to in the moment is a reversal of about 20 or 30 years of Labor broadening its appeal to people that want to kind of, who have aspirations to build wealth outside their super fund or outside their principal place of residence. Because to be really clear, is this budget, you know, very clearly acknowledges that even people that go to work every day, who are saving for a house, it wants to protect their right to create wealth in super, and I think that's great, and to protect their right to create wealth in the principal place of residence. What this has done, it's chosen one little area of the economy of wealth creation, which is business formation, and it's come down on that area like a ton of bricks. And actually, I think that area is a really natural area of expansion and appeal for Labor. It's not its heart and soul. It's the way that it maintains a stable majority as populist parties from the right and from the left grow in appeal. And that is clearly becoming easier and more effective. And there's a whole series of reasons for that. And so I do think right now is not the time to choose to say, we've got to choose between fairness and economic growth. No, we have to choose both. Mm-hmm. The Labor Party, good Labor governments choose both, and that's how they maintain long-term government.
We have seen polls since the budget that have not been very warm, I guess, for the government. And particularly this week, a poll from Redbridge that showed One Nation had actually overtaken Labor in terms of a primary vote for the first time. Do you put that down to the budget, at least in significant part?
Yeah, look, to be clear, Labor's primary vote has been coming down for decades, right? Like, if you take every single Labor election and clump it into the decade that it falls in, Labor's primary vote falls basically by 2 or 3% every decade for the last 3 or 4 decades. So this is not about one budget. It's not about one prime minister or one treasurer even. This is a long-term phenomena. I think when you choose mechanisms like this, when you basically create a kind of such a negative reaction from a very broad-based group of people, young people who want to invest in shares, young people who want to start a business, people who have started a business, people who kind of want to invest in high-growth businesses rather than just putting their money in an index fund, that's a large group of people. When you sort of react, when you create a measure which had no consultation, no pre-consultation, and you spring it on people on budget night, what you do is you narrow the number of people who are like, you know what, Labor has broadened itself and has appealed to me. And despite all the kind of the cheap, sugary, populist appeal of a One Nation or a Greens, I'm going to stick with the people in the middle who are being really serious and considered and broadening their appeal. And actually, I think what I was quite surprised about is I think this budget is unwinding a much longer project inside the Labor Party to broaden its appeal. And I understand the emotional resonance of this kind of fairness argument, and I support the idea that we have to get the tax settings right, including reducing the tax on Labor and funding that somehow. Now, the problem is, again, what this has done has chosen the kind of all the bits of the economy I'd choose, because obviously you could change the tax settings, you could change the corporate tax rate settings, you can change the superannuation tax rate settings, you can change all sorts of settings, you can change the tax settings on the principal place of residence. If it's, let's be clear, there's lots of different levers you can pull. We pulled the one that really smashes growth companies.
Mm. Putting aside the capital gains tax changes, the budget entirely, do you think the government, this government, is doing enough to foster innovation and entrepreneurship, and what should it be doing?
I think it was doing a really, really good job. I think, unfortunately, and I think they did do some stuff in the budget which is important around R&D, around the instant asset write-off. I think, unfortunately, they've sort of unwound all their good work with a very small piece of bad work. What I would say is Labor's primary vote is hovering in the high 20s, right? Maybe the low 30s on a good year. If Labor doesn't continue the process of broadening their appeal, if they narrow that, that is going to basically accelerate that process downwards. It's going to accelerate that drop, which has been happening for multiple decades, and there will be a point where we will open ourselves up to vulnerability, the country I'm talking about here when I say we, mm-hmm. To kind of insurgent parties from the left and the right. So I really would say, I think...
So you think this is an existential threat?
I don't think it's an existential threat. I think it's... Labor is very vulnerable. Despite the 93 seats, the primary vote is extremely low and it's been going down for decades. There is a point... Think about the rise of minor parties like a volcano on the seafloor. They don't look that scary whilst they're kind of building up under the ocean, but the moment they crack above the ocean, above sea level, suddenly you understand how big and scary they are. And that's the point where we are in the political cycle right now. I've been writing for 10 years about the rise of the minor party, started in 2016 talking about it. It's been clear on the nose. It's been very, very clear this has been coming for a long time. And this is the worst possible, just as they're about one of these parties, and it looks like it's going to be One Nation, is going to peak above the kind of sea level, and suddenly we'll understand just how broad their support is. We've gone around a project of kind of narrowing our base and lowering our appeal, particularly to young people who kind of have the aspiration to start a business or do some investment on the side. That's the worst possible time to do that, because now is a time to be broad. Now is a time to be stable, to basically to appeal to a large number of people, because these competitors, populist parties, are very formidable in the current environment, particularly with the cost of living crisis, with the difficulty around buying a house. And now is not the time to kind of revert to a narrower form of the Labor Party and to narrow Labor's appeal.
Lachlan Harris, we'll have to leave it there. Thanks so much for your insights.
Thanks, David.
And that's all we've got time for here on Insiders on Background. David Spears will be, of course, with you on Sunday on ABC TV for Insiders with all the week's politics. And PK will be back on this podcast feed from Monday. I'm David Lipson. Thanks for being with us.
You're making us all feel very excited about being here.